This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Front Runner Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. In one of the rooms in the Day One Philharmonic Patronus, which houses the MPO when it convenes to perform. This weekend, the orchestra will be playing with the choir of Clare College, University of Cambridge. And presently, I'm with Graham Ross, fellow and director of music at the university, and who has been responsible for the choir of Clare College since 2010. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
You have a choir. I assume every year you meet a new batch of young people. What story do you tell them to kind of win them over?
Well, the first thing to recognise is that actually there's more than one choir in the university. There are actually 31 colleges that make up the University of Cambridge. And with each of those colleges, there is a chapel choir. And so there are 31 choirs for prospective students to see which one is going to be the one that they want to sing in for 3 years. So it is quite competitive in that sense. So you have to, if you like, provide something that draws them into your choir more than other choirs, despite the fact, of course, we're all very friendly with each other and their colleagues. They're not competitors. But at Clare College, we have a distinguished history of a mixed-voice choir. We were one of the first colleges to admit women back in the early 1970s. And so from the last 40 or so years, we've had a mixed-voice choir of men and women. Unlike our neighbours at King's College, which is men and boys, and at St John's College a little further down the road. And I suppose that, if you like, is one of the main draws, particularly, of course, for female singers, that they get to sing with what we hope is a world-class choir in, obviously, a world-class university. What they don't find on Wikipedia and what they don't find on the internet, I don't know. There's not that many secrets that we keep from them. I mean, the best thing that they discover is when they come up informally, before they start their official degree at the university, and they just come and get a sense of what it's like to be a singer in a choir like Clare College. And that's something that you can't really persuade someone to do. They have to feel it inside themselves.
Do you take students only from Clare College, or do you take them from all colleges?
So most of the members of my choir are members of the Clare College as an academic institution. And first and foremost, you can't sing in a university choir unless you have an academic place to sing in the university. So whilst we may like to think that the most important reason why they're there is to be a singer, actually the most important reason is for them to get a degree.
Which begs the question, why are students going into a university to study engineering and sciences, and Cambridge is known for its technologies? Why are they spending so much time singing? Because based on my understanding, they sing for chapel services. These students are traveling, they are recording.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there is a very rich tradition of particularly choral singing in England, which goes back many, many centuries. And King's College Chapel next door to us, which was built by Henry VIII, has been standing there for many, many hundreds of years. And all the way through those years, there's been this rich tradition of people coming to sing, and in this particular case, to sing music for the liturgy, for the church. And that's something that's very special and that I don't think is particularly captive elsewhere in the world. It's a particular thing unique to England. And the English choral tradition is something that is cherished and loved around the world, not just, of course, in the UK, but in everywhere that we go on tour when we travel. I think that obviously you can study music as an academic subject, and there are usually, say, 5 or 6 members of my choir who make music their major, their principal subject. But the other students are studying a whole range of subjects, from the sciences to languages to mathematics, Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic, and these weird and wonderful subjects that they study. But they're really committed to their singing. And I think, in answer to your question, what they want to achieve is a level of singing that is as important to them as their academic studies. So they're very focused in the library and in their lectures, studying astrophysics or whatever it is that they've chosen to study, but they want to come and sing to a very high level.
I believe you were from Clare College yourself, and I assume then you studied music.
I did. I read music at Clare, yeah.
And also as an educator, how important is music to a scientist, to a businessman?
It's really important. I mean, thankfully, there are more and more studies today that show that singing is something that is good for you. You know, just the very nature of sharing something that is inherent to us. We have no instruments. It's simply our bodies and the sound that we produce from inside us. And that's something that, of course, has been going on since the world began. I think it's something that is very good for people in some cases to focus on their studies if they are a musician, but equally if they're a scientist or a mathematician, it gives them something that is completely different from their studies. And what I often find is that particularly in the examination term, which is our third semester in the university, which takes place from around about April to June, it's a time when the students are typically quite stressed and they are quite challenged by their academic rigours. And of course, Cambridge being one of the world's great universities, it's not an easy journey. There's no one pretends that it is. But a lot of my students in the choir say is that that term in particular is a term that they really relish the opportunity to be a member of a choir, because it takes them out of that stress and into something completely different that switches their mind off and is hopefully something that they really love doing, whether or not they choose to go on and do it professionally.
So you think that music has a part to play in the lives of non-musical people, in the sense that they're not going to make this their profession?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the amateur music scene, particularly in the United Kingdom, is very rich. And that goes from consort groups. I mean, we're just talking about singers here. Of course, the amateur instrumental scene is just as important. But focusing on singers, there are many small choirs, consorts, choral societies. It goes right the way through to the day that you die, and you can be an amateur musician right up into your 90s or however long you're going to live for. But it forms a very important part of people's lives. And I think that when you have sung to the level that we hope that we achieve in the university, and you have to remember, of course, these are young people. They're only 18 to 21. They have the whole of the rest of their lives ahead of them. But once they've achieved that level and they've tasted some professional music life, like what we're doing here in Kuala Lumpur, is that they hopefully have that excitement, that frisson of excitement to go out there and continue doing it, whether, as I say, it's as part of their professional lives or amateur.
I assume to participate in this choir, you have to audition. What's the background of these singers who come into this kind of choir? Are they already musicians of some caliber?
Some are and some aren't. Typically, at Clare College, I admit around about 10 or 12 students per year to sing in the choir. And that makes up roughly a third of our choir, which is usually numbering around about 30. And typically, at the end of each year, I lose a third of them because they go on and they graduate and they start their lives. And so I have to replace those thirds. And people come from all sorts of different backgrounds. There are some people who have been perhaps fortunate to sing in a school choir where perhaps there was a particular tradition, or maybe they sang in a church choir in their local town or village where they grew up, or there are some national choirs in the United Kingdom. National Youth Choir of Great Britain is one, for example, which a number of singers have sung in before. But actually, there are a lot of students who maybe have just sung in the shower, or maybe have sung a few tunes when they were little and at home and have some musicality inside them, but perhaps haven't had the opportunity to express that. And it's my job as director of music to find those people and to try and see the potential. And I think you have to remember that when they apply, they're often age 17. And at that stage, the voice is very much not developed. You know, it still changes over the next, certainly 3 or 4 years, sometimes 10, 20 years. And so it's my job to see the potential inside them and hopefully make the right decision that it becomes realised.
You mentioned that you lose a third of them every year because of graduation. What are the challenges of developing a sound from a particular choir when you're losing a third of your members?
It's the hardest thing about the job, but it is definitely part of the job, and I take comfort in the fact that there are 30 other directors of music who have the same problem as me at the beginning of the year. I always say that the first 2 or 3 weeks of the semester, if you like, the beginning of the season, are the most important weeks. They're the weeks that you really have to hone the sound and make work with the forces that you have. And because they are primarily there academically, not as choral students, then sometimes inevitably there are difficulties and upsets where people perhaps don't obtain their academic grades. And so I might have a fantastic soprano who I've auditioned, who I'm very excited, who's coming into the choir, and sadly they don't make their academic offer, and so I'm back to the drawing board. And there are other times where there's very pleasant surprises, where I think someone's not going to get in, and they do get in. So, you know, it kind of evens out. But in terms of making that sound, you really, I think, have to work very hard in those first few weeks, not take on any freelance engagements outside, and really focus for a good fortnight so that you work on the sound that you have. I think what English singers particularly do is they work very well at speed. And in Cambridge, that is something that is particularly useful because we sing three services a week. And in each of those services, we sing six or seven different pieces that form part of the service. And we do about 25 services a term, three terms a year, 3 years of their degree. By the time they've graduated, they've sung about 700 services with each about six or seven pieces of music. So by the end, they have an enormous repertoire that they have studied and become familiar with. And of course, a lot of it, I hope, is unfamiliar to them at the beginning. And that's part of the joy of being a director of music, is you get to train them in something that perhaps has been unfamiliar to them to start with.
How much time are these students spending in music, especially when music is not their major?
So at Clare College, the students typically give about 10 hours of their week to choir time with me. And sometimes it's a little more than that, particularly if there's a special concert or a broadcast or a TV, whatever. And in the vacations, outside of the semesters, the students can be expected to give up to around about 8 weeks each year to the external activities that we do. And that could be anything from concerts, obviously in Cambridge and particularly in London, but around the United Kingdom. We tour internationally at least once every year, often more. We record for Harmonia Mundi, and we typically record two discs every year, as well as doing radio and TV broadcasts. They have a pretty busy schedule, but it's something that they really thrive on, and they get some extraordinary opportunities in doing that.
You talk about the sound that you try to create. How would you describe this sound?
That's a very good question, and it's a question that I think is difficult to answer, and I promise I'm not just trying to skirt around the answer. The difficulty, or if you like, the excitement of a changing choir is you inevitably have a different sound each year. But of course, in the back of our minds, I know how I want a piece of Thomas Tallis to sound, and I know how I want a piece of Johannes Brahms to sound. And those two sounds are rather different. And if you like, we try to homogenize the sound so that it is suitable to the particular style or the particular piece that they're performing. So the advantage of having female sopranos and altos as opposed to boy trebles is typically the voices are a little more developed. They have a little more natural sense of vibrato. Their musicianship is obviously 10 years older than a boy treble. And so we can ask the sopranos, for example, if in a Tallis motet, they could strip away the vibrato and give a very pure, clean sound like you might expect from a boy chorister. But equally, when it comes to Brahms motet or something much more romantic in its sound, you can ask them to sing with more of their natural body. And that, I think, is something that perhaps you can't do with boy trebles. So we kind of have the best of both worlds, and we sing a huge range of repertoire. And I try to adapt the sound depending on what the piece is.
You have two concerts this week, one tonight and one over the weekend. The repertoire or the program for both are quite different. Tell us what's going to happen this evening. They sound more like church service music.
It's a whole mixture of music. It's, if you like, it's a snapshot of what you might hear if you were to come to Clare College and our beautiful chapel in England and hear the choir perform, as we do, three times a week. And there is some music from the church, from the liturgy, as well as some secular music. And that, if you like, forms a snapshot of what Clare College Choir does on an annual basis. We don't just sing the music of the church, but we are fortunate to be invited to work with other great orchestras and great choirs and great conductors, which enable us to do secular repertoire as well. So in previous years, for example, we did a big tour of Australia doing Beethoven 9 with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. We just this year premiered a major new piece from Alexander Raskatov with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. And here at the weekend, we performed the 1812 Overture with words, which is not done very often.
In fact, I was quite surprised. I didn't know that there were words that go with this piece of music.
So it's a reinstatement, if you like, of the original tunes that Tchaikovsky chose when he wrote his 1812 Overture, which, of course, is often and usually done just with instruments.
Cannons.
And cannons, of course, of which... We have cannons at the weekend, but hopefully the roof of Petronas won't be blown off. But the opening of the 1812, which is usually played by the violas and the cellos, is replaced here by the choir singing this beautiful Orthodox Russian chant. And then at bar 34, the double basses come in with this huge, great low G with a timpani, and then you're back into the 1812 that everyone knows. And there are little surprises as you go along the way, melodies that everyone knows, which suddenly you hear words being sung to. I think it should be quite a spectacular finale.
What informs the putting together of this program? I mean, are you trying to also assume this is your first time in Malaysia?
It is.
That you also would like to kind of show what Clare College Choir can do?
I think that's right. Yeah, it's a very, particularly our programme this evening, is a very broad-ranging programme, and it's music right the way from the Renaissance up to the present day, including an arrangement that was made this year, you know, so it really is everything in between as well. And that's something that we pride ourselves on. We like, and I particularly like as a composer as well, juxtaposing pieces that are both familiar and less familiar, new and old, complex and simple, mellifluous and hard-edged, you know, it's a real mixed bag, and that's something that the singers really enjoy the process of doing. And as I said earlier, changing the sound that they produce for each different piece is, I hope, something that we achieve with a good level of success. When it comes to orchestral concerts, it's, if you like, it's a little easier to program because the pieces typically are a little longer than a cappella works. But it should be, for me, something that is both enjoyable and informative, both for the performers and the audience alike. And I think our concerts at the weekend with MPO are exactly that. We have this wonderful requiem of Gabriel Fauré from the late 19th century, with beautiful, rather small and intimate forces. There are no violins, apart from one solo violin, just the viola, cellos, basses in the string section. We have the Bernstein Chichester Psalms, a great, loud, joyful, jubilant work for very large percussion section and the choir.
Male soprano?
And we have a female mezzo singing the second movement of that, the very beautiful Adonai movement. And then these two wonderful brass fanfares that open each half. The first one from Dukas, who's most famous, I think, for his Sorcerer's Apprentice piece. And then the wonderful fanfare for The Common Man by Aaron Copland. So there's a very much a French flavour, an American flavour, and then the canons at the end to bring the concert to a close in the 1812.
But you're here for another weekend.
I am.
And this time, no choir.
No choir next week. I'm delighted to be staying on to do next weekend's concerts with the MPO as well, to do some family concerts, as we explore a programme that is themed around animals, centred around Saint-Saëns's great Carnival of the Animals, which sees the orchestra represented as lions and as donkeys, creatures with long ears, a beautiful movement for the swan, and a whole variety of other instruments. And around that, we have put together a programme which has other composers who have written about animals. And it's a pretty wide-ranging and, I hope, exciting programme. We hear some Gershwin, we hear some of Swan Lake from Tchaikovsky, we have the opportunity to hear some Stravinsky, his very exciting Dance Infernal from the Firebird Suite, as well as some other works. It forms, I hope, a really good programme for young and old alike.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, thank you.
I've been speaking with Graham Ross, guest conductor for the MPO this weekend. He has brought with him the choir of Clare College, University of Cambridge. There is a choir recital today at 8:30 p.m. and tickets to the performance are priced at R50 and R70. On Saturday at 8:30 and Sunday at 3 p.m, the choir will be accompanied by the Malaysian Philharmonic Orchestra and tickets are priced from R100 to R200. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Ex Maria Virgine, gaudete, 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 Christus est natus. Ex Maria Virgine, gaudete.
Tempus Virgis Fructus.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.